Welcome to Ojibwe Stories, Gaganunada. I'm your host, Eric Reddix. We're having a conversation with Gordon Jourdain, who grew up in the Ojibwe community of Lac La Croix in northwest Ontario. Last time you were here, we talked about, you know, you growing up and the kind, and it was wintertime, so the kinds of things that you would do in the winter. What kinds of things would you do this time of year in the summer? Like, what was the community doing?
Most of the times in the summer, actually every day we swam in the water.
Mm-hmm.
But we also used watercraft. We're most of the people that I know, my age and younger, at the village where I grew up, are expert canoeists and swimmers.
Mm-hmm.
And people who can go through the forest and waterways at night and still find where they're going.
Mm-hmm.
I know many of my cousins are like that, my brothers too. We spent a lot of time playing in the forest. Of course, we never had any store-bought toys to play with.
Mm-hmm.
We hardly had any Western clothing to wear. When we went swimming, we would just use a shirt like this and tie it over ourselves to go swimming.
Mm-hmm.
Or if we were alone, we'd just go skinny dipping with the boys. And that's what I remember most. And we used to always go practice our hunting prowess with slingshots, and we made bows and arrows, and I want to even say that some of my friends even subsisted on eating birds and fish and plants and berries, because we didn't have any kind of a store to go buy sweets from. I remember, it may sound cruel, but eating all kinds of different birds, chickadees, robins, woodpeckers. They were tasty, but we were practicing our hunting skills indirectly until our parents or our grandparents were comfortable enough to let us go off with, you know, firearms.
Mm-hmm.
We were properly, not through lessons, but through talking about safety with firearms. I didn't have a firearm in my hand until I was probably 14 years old, but I knew all about it prior to that, and how to safely walk with one of those and how to handle it and everything, because to an Ojibwe or traditional person, a firearm is a living spirit that you have to know how to handle that. And canoes, we didn't get on those until we were probably around that same, well, at least I didn't get on them until I actually really knew how to handle one of those, because it's serious. You could get into a lot of trouble.
Definitely.
So that's how it was like. Every day of our existence was indirectly related to a formal education on the things that we needed to learn to survive. They weren't formal at all. Like, today your lesson will be how to handle a canoe. It wasn't like that. But everything that we did, we were trained not just by our parents.
Right.
Our brothers, our cousins, our aunts, everybody in the community took part, participated in ensuring that these children that were in the community were being educated properly with ethical and moral values. And as you know, in the naming ceremony, you have weans there.
Mm-hmm.
And they are the ones that are given the responsibility by using tobacco to ensure that our little children are going to be given the proper training or education, if you want to call it that. That is our responsibility as weans to do that.
Right. That's important we do that, right?
Of course. And sometimes, you know, our parents do not have their eyes on us all the time, but we have older siblings, we have uncles or aunts that say, hey, hold on here. Let me show you how to do that, or let me help you with that. It's not a scolding. It could be if it's something that's really, really serious that we're not supposed to be doing, but it's a healthy scolding. It's not like just to whack the child, but to teach them discipline.
Back then, is that the way people handled bad behavior? Did they handle it differently? Was there more scoldings? Was it different?
Yeah, it was extremely different, and that is what is permeating through our discussion, is we handle conflict in an extremely different way than do other ways of handling things.
Right.
My mother was we didn't want to mess with her. She was a strict disciplinarian compared to my father. My father was really, really gentle. My father never raised his voice, but my mother was the opposite. They were like two extremes.
Mm-hmm.
But they kept most of us on the straight and narrow, and so did everybody in the community. Everybody was involved with that. But now you can't do that. In other spaces, you can't do that. And that's how it's getting to be in the community where I grew up, is the parents will come in and scold you if you say anything to their children.
But back then, it was okay.
Yep. Yeah, it was okay. Kid. If I did anything and I knew I did, my mother would say, you know what, your aunt came here today. I'm like, I didn't mean to start crying.
As an educator now, do you think that approach is better, even in our more westernized society today, having that, you know, group approach to it?
Personally, my philosophy is as an adult, I feel very privileged to be able to have a classroom full of children. And I'm honored to be able to be in that position.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's a tremendous responsibility for me to ensure that all of the children that are in my classroom and how they deal with others in the school is in a healthy way.
Right.
For me, that's what I believe.
Getting back to kind of your growing up, was there a lot of movement with this, you know, having to go out and, you know, do these different things in order to survive? Like where you had to pick up and say, okay, we're going here today to do, you know, whatever, berry picking.
We did everything by the seasons, though.
Mm-hmm.
That would determine what the activity would be. All of the 13 months of the cycle of our journey around the sun.
Mm-hmm.
That would determine what we did. But what I remember as a child, it was always active.
Hmm.
Everybody was outside. Nobody was inside, except for the elders maybe, but most of them would be outside, you know, sharing their knowledge with everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But now when I go to the community where I grew up, there's no children anywhere.
Because they have, what, Xbox?
Yeah, and no adults doing anything outside. Nobody out on the lake doing things. Because they all have a road and they all have vehicles now.
Yeah.
And what I said was, and I put myself in that situation, but I left the reservation when I was like 18 years old. I struggled for a long time trying to understand how to be like in a society that I didn't grow up in.
Mm-hmm.
But it's because it's relatively new for the people where I grew up at. It's difficult for them to instantaneously understand what is going on with these things until maybe it's too late.
Hmm. Getting back to kids and how they should behave kind of today, this time of year, is there certain things that we should kind of keep an eye on our kids for? And I guess, for example, is that they say, you know, when your kids are out by the water, they shouldn't like throw rocks at the lake, things like that. Is there certain ways that we should be mindful as parents that kids show respect for the outdoors?
Having grown up in a tremendously strong traditional Ojibwe upbringing, of course, I had these ideas that I'm talking about when I say one voice. I share them with you because I went through a transformational stage,
mm-hmm.
where at one time I only had one voice in my head that explained everything. But because of forcing myself to be in uncomfortable spaces,
mm-hmm.
where I can't be myself or try to explain who I am to others, I've learned to understand and accept a lot of things. I'll give you one example. There was this one idea that I had that the way that I was raised traditionally was the only way that you could be raised to be an Anishinaabe person, with the language, with the ceremonies, with adapting to the environment that you're living in, being able to follow the seasons. I thought that was the only way to understand who you are as an Anishinaabe person. Well, I think differently now.
Mm-hmm.
That is a part of that. I also understand now that there were ferocious, vicious policies,
mm-hmm.
institutions, governments, schools, churches that were mandated or given the responsibility to remove who we are,
right,
as Anishinaabe people. And as a grandfather, a father and a brother and a son. Of course, as a first language speaker, I would, to save my children from the harassment of Western society, I would not teach them the language.
Mm-hmm.
I understand what that is now.
Right.
And I don't want to say I know why they did that, but I think I would have, being in the same situation, I would have not spoken Ojibwe to my children. But that doesn't necessarily mean that what you were saying to them in English does not come from an understanding of who you are as a Native American person.
Right.
There are a lot of students that I talk to that I have also in Ojibwe immersion that are relearning the language that they should have learned. And some of them, and you and I have talked about this before in another show, they just can't learn it as fast as somebody who is not Native American.
Yeah.
And I think at one time we said maybe our methods are different in teaching it. We went through all that in a previous show. But I want to encourage those people that because their grandparents or their parents did not speak to them in Ojibwe, it does not necessarily mean that they do not know how to be Ojibwe or Native American thinking people.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been transformed that way. Because I went out and met some very wonderful people who are not like me. And we need to be able to break away from the mold of living in communities that are controlled by the one voice that I keep talking about.
Mm-hmm. This is Ojibwe Stories Gaganunanada, a program of Ojibwe culture. Our guest today is Gordon Jourdain, who grew up in the Ojibwe community of Lac La Croix in northwest Ontario.
Ki pona o si ji jat ngoje. Ngozan ma jada. I remember my grandmother only spoke Ojibwe, but that didn't deter her from getting to where we wanted to go, because everybody in her life and my life spoke Ojibwe. And she would make arrangements. And I don't know how she did, because we didn't have a phone. But we would fly out of the village where I grew up, go to Crane Lake, Minnesota, which was the closest community to ours that we could get to have access to different forms of transportation. We would just get in the plane and fly out and go. And in the summertime, it was later spring, a little later fall, in between that time, that space of time, would be when we would travel to other communities. We'd go live in Saint River for a month, because we still have relatives there.
Right.
We'd go to Lake Vermilion for a month or so. We have relatives there. And then we'd go to Annette Lake, Minnesota. We have relatives there too. And then we have relatives in Grand Portage, Minnesota. So along that border country, all those people are interrelated, like related to all of them. Especially my family, my mother's family is from Minnesota. My dad's is from Ontario. So I have a big family. And it's through that network of family, I believe, how we were able to get to where we were, we wanted to go, despite my grandmother not speaking English. All my life, I was her principal translator. So I have an extremely high level of understanding of the original Ojibwe dialect where I come from. And traditionally, during that span from late spring, when the waterways would open, until later fall, when of course the animals would go into the deep forest, is socializing time.
Right.
Was, and still when I was growing up, was an extremely important time for us to leave the community where we were at to go and socialize with relatives. And of course our main event for socializing these days are our ceremonies. We go to powwows, or we go to midday, or we go to a big drum, and we still have those. We still do that during that time frame that I'm talking about. Or it could be just as family that goes to pick berries for the week. It's Minan, or one of the bigger events. And I don't want to say that all the other ones are not as big or meaningful, but the Manominike Gizis, where we go and gather wild rice, that's another big time for, because people used to actually go and live there. They didn't have the cars to jump in and put their canoe on the truck and go for the day and then come home. They actually had to go live there for a week or two. And that was a beautiful time for socializing. And hunting, of course, there'd be ducks there.
Yep.
Ducks galore at the rice fields.
Hmm.
That's what I was talking about in that little bit of a Ojibwe that you heard. In the winter would be Genidegwagi Gidasha Miapia Gaujita Wata Nigi Gogmino Niseyagi Gipagitabi Wagipagipagitabi Nawa Ibiminakwan Aname Mikoming Aname Zigomugiatunawa Biminakwan Migo Pigane Age Kiushkabane Ting Magjao ege pitisita mikom gavine asi gon me api jibe jigo anamizigo ebe namo ate I goting metigo tava chituna wa che chaya wa pimina kon kisko gi jita wa tesh pimina kon misa yoga baby bona gigo kitamo gigo mi maish bagita wa wat Kiuska baneting. Minoa uni gavaka, kiuni gavak de teban, minoa anisek, kibipun nekoginuchawa, manitana, amikun, shangoshuan, nikig, kikinigogo, ogotuinigo, good thing a washkishan opina one, machawak, gabi giagota, chibob mashkawating. machawag ni sachuan kugi shawag kendo mashkawachi wagiwite pamamino agib matgaku bisawat kibi matgaku at mi o kibi machawat kabe igi nendi wag kung kuting nijo na me egi jik magshage ngo nigo na me egi jik ngo gizis tigo gini nendi wag pamagi mashkawaku tingi o tagushinawat ngo yak kungi kweno eni ma de teban gi kweno eni ma ki kono ni maksa go kakina ni mino ga ischi ge at kene kene si gon ki macha wag kabe igi inendi wag baba baba ni ge wat ni mino ba ma gi ni gi tene ki ni gisat kon gi ba ki begin si ben mino sa ge ganan mi obji ne gi pe ya wat mino gi pi gi we wat ni ga ischi ge wat ki ni bi ne ni gi das ki ya wa ka ki pe ma uji we wa ki ma inga Peshe maya ia, enda se kata se anu kiyo at kakina nishna vegi utiga kita shinta vegi at. In the fall, my father and my older brothers would prepare for trapping for the winter and for trapping season because that would be the end of the fishing season for them.
Mm-hmm.
So later in the fall when the snow started, when it got colder and colder and colder, they'd go down river Nisachiwan in the canoes. And then go and freeze over there. I mean, I translate that again to Meshkawakuji, again to Gibuchiwak. Like they went over there until everything froze over right. So they could walk back home yep. across the ice. Sometimes that would be like 2 weeks or 4 weeks. But they would bring all their dried hides with them.
Mm-hmm.
Your beaver, your otters, and all those different kinds of hides that they would sell at a resort that was like 3 miles down from the village where we were at. That's where they would sell all their furs to. So they'd trap fur-bearing animals all winter. And in the spring again, when before the waterways would open, they'd go across the lakes and the rivers to get to where the trapping ground were.
Mm-hmm.
And then they stayed there again for 2 to 4 weeks.
Right,
until the waterways opened so they could travel and bring their canoes back again. So that's how they subsisted over the course of the year. And then in the spring, when everything opened up, they'd be fishing guides from early spring till late fall.
Huh.
And then that's when they would pay off their bills at the local general store or whatever that place was. So they'd work all summer and pay off their bills to get enough credit so they could go and trap for the winter. So it was cyclical like that.
Yep.
And I'm not sure how many people are still doing that at the village where I grew up. I think some of my cousins are still doing that, kind of subsistence.
So the duck thing, how did that work? Because I've always wondered this, you know, when you read different things and say, you know, the women knocked the rice. Well, first of all, was it just women knocking rice when you were growing up, or was it both men and women?
I didn't spend a lot of time in the rice fields with my parents, because
mm-hmm.
by the time that I was growing up, they had dammed the waterways to a level where they destroyed all of the traditional ricing that apparently they used to do. But there were some places that is one place. It's called Wild Goose Creek,
mm-hmm.
Wild Goose River, or whatever that is. Nikes,
mm-hmm.
little goose. That's where my mother and I would go. And this is what I related in one story
mm-hmm.
where I was. That's where we would go and pick some rice.
Right.
After school, we'd drive over there and put in at least an hour of ricing. We wouldn't get very much, but we'd go multiple times. And the other part I remember is going ricing with my friend Justin. And the rice was like really, really high. Like,
right.
How do we get it out of there? I remember trying to push him through the rice paddies, trying to get at the rice. There were a few years that it was good when I was younger, like, mm-hmm. in my teens, when I was able to go out there, like, I don't know, 16, 17 years old, I guess, or younger. But not when I was a kid. I hardly ever went out with them. But I did a lot of hunting with my brothers and my cousins. And that's where I know about ducks. And I know how to prepare them. I know how to get the feathers off and cut up the ducks. And those are the things that I learned from my mother.
So would they do it at the same time? If they were out ricing, they might... Would they have a gun? Because I always wanted to kick up so many ducks when you're out there.
Yeah, they'd have a shotgun with them. Yep.
So you just stop and hold on.
Yeah, hold on. Here's supper coming. And, you know, they'd get deer, too, that way. they always carried a shotgun or at least a 22, because you always had to be prepared to, to survive and eat whatever was available or happened to be walking by. You always had to be prepared for that. And that's what I remember is the resort that I'm talking about is like about maybe 3 miles from the village where I grew up. And the times when I talked about my father and my brothers would leave, that would be a hard time to move around.
Yeah.
Because it would be too dangerous to walk on the water. And yet you had to go and you had to go get things. Yeah. So I would travel with my mom. And my mom would show me how to trap beaver. And my mom also showed me how to hunt.
So did you eat them?
Yeah.
The beaver?
Yeah, we ate the beaver.
Muskrats maybe too? Or?
My mom ate the muskrats. I didn't. She would put them in the oven and roast them.
Huh.
It was a delicacy for them, but.
Would it smell, the muskrat, when you're cooking them in the oven inside?
I can't recall. Maybe that's why I didn't eat them, because when I was a child, I was a really finicky eater.
Mm-hmm.
And if something smelled, I didn't eat it. My dad used to eat he loved onions. And dang, they stunk when I was a kid. But you know what? The funny thing is, I just love onions now. I accidentally tried them once, and I just like how they taste. But as a kid, you're finicky.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty common, huh?
Yeah.
Because I didn't like onions or peppers or anything until I was in my 20s, so. Huh, muskrat.
No, I never ate muskrat. I tried to, but all that stuff is really gamey.
Tasting, yeah.
Beaver is really gamey, too, but it's definitely an acquired taste.
Huh.
If things are, smoked, it kind of gets rid of that gaminess in stuff, and it's really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
I like beaver when it's smoked.
Hmm.
I like name too, sturgeon, when it's smoked.
Yeah.
I even like the carp or suckerfish when it's smoked.
Huh.
It's good, yeah. Smoked wias, noki ogwan. Ooh, that stuff is good.
That's all the time we have today. I want to thank our guest Gordon Jourdain for sharing his stories with us. This is Ojibwe Stories Gaganunanada. I'm your host, Eric Reddix. To listen again to past episodes of the program online, visit the program page at kumd.org and click on Ojibwe Stories. Ojibwe Stories Gaganunanada is produced by KUMD and the Tribal Sovereignty Institute at the University of Minnesota Duluth, home of the Master of Tribal Administration and Governance, or MTAG, program, where students learn about leadership, law, sovereignty, and management from a tribal perspective. MTAG was designed by tribes for tribes, currently accepting applications for fall enrollment. More information can be found at umdmtag.org. Funding for Ojibwe Stories Gaganunanada is provided in part by the UMD College of Education and Human Service Professions and by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.